Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. By the way, a couple of quick reminders here that you can subscribe to us any place they have podcasts, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. And I want to thank all the listeners of the podcast. We've now crossed 11 million total downloads after our biggest month ever. In March, we had more than 1 million downloads just in the month of March. So we really appreciate that. A special shout out to all of our guests and all of our listeners and producers who've put this together. Also, in case you are still missing out, if you haven't subscribed to our newsletters, in addition to The Bulwark, obviously we publish three newsletters a day. You can get The Bulwark in your inbox in the morning, midday, and late in the afternoon. I put out morning shots in the morning. JVL, Jonathan Last, puts out his triad about midday. And then Jim Swift looks back at all the headlines of the day later in the afternoon. All of this is free. We have no paywall. If you want to subscribe to this podcast or you want to subscribe to the newsletters, they are free and they're going to stay free. And this has been really an extraordinary period for those of us at The Bulwark. So, okay, so let's start Tuesday. It is Tuesday, and it's happy days are here again, apparently. If you listen to the president's news conference, if you look at the stock market, our special guest on this particular happy snapback Tuesday is Matt Lewis, senior columnist for The Daily Beast. How are you, Matt?
Hey, Charlie, doing well.
Okay, so where should we start? Should we talk with, I have to just mention, okay, so I'm getting ready to go out and vote on Wisconsin's pandemic election. You know, we had all the maneuvering, all the mixed signals, the partisan dumb bleep, you know, and multiple court rulings, including the U.S. Supreme Court, and we have to go out and vote. So, I mean, and to say that the people are confused, that it is chaotic and confused here is kind of putting it mildly. I mean, there's not a lot of good options for running an election in the middle of a pandemic, but somehow Wisconsin, and in a very bipartisan way, has managed to come up with this solution that may be the worst of all possible worlds. And I'm getting blowback. People, what do you mean both sides? Well, Governor Tony Evers is the Democrat, and he didn't decide to shut this thing down until Friday. And even though he'd issued a stay-at-home order. And then yesterday, after days and days of saying he did not have the legal authority to cancel the election, he did. He issued an executive order, and he basically was conceding he didn't have any legal basis to do it. So not a surprise the courts brought it back. But so I'm just waiting. Just Matt, I'm waiting for my hazmat suit to be delivered here. I have the mask. Okay, so Stephanie Grisham. She's out as press secretary. What's your best memory of Stephanie Grisham?
She had some Fox and Friends hits, I think.
But never once gave a press briefing.
Yeah, that's the asterisk. That's going to be a Trivial Pursuit question someday, right? I mean, the
name
of
press secretary.
It's historic.
Well, apparently they don't have an interlock system in the briefing room. Oh, I was not going to take that cheap shot. I wasn't going to do all of that. So what do you want to start with? You want to talk about the president's briefing yesterday? You want to talk about the Secretary of the Navy? I'll let you decide.
Let me just go back to your opening with Wisconsin,
yeah. Oh,
Charlie.
Yeah.
And,
sure.
You had a really good piece in The Bulwark about it. But I think the part that you bring up that is really the most concerning is what does this say about November?
Oh, yeah.
And I don't want to get too scared yet, but this is like a canary in the coal mine. And we really have to have a plan in place because we don't know what the world is going to look like in November. And I just don't think that this country can have a general election in November for president where it's not legitimate. That would be so devastating. We're already so torn apart right now. So that is something that I think is very concerning.
Oh, I think it's very concerning. And I don't think it's paranoid to bring this up. And I think the canary in the coal mine part was that, number one, the courts are not going to rescue us. They're going to divide along the normal ideological lines. There's not going to be some sort of a bipartisan, good government, common sense solution to all of this, where the courts say, well, of course, we're not going to force Americans to choose between exercising their civic duty and protecting their health. We can't possibly do that. No, they're going to take kind of a hands off on all of this. And also, I mean, partisan rancor is nothing new. But watching in Wisconsin is a reminder that Republicans are really, frankly, going to go. They're going to go balls to the wall to stop any sort of mail-in ballot expansion or reforms that might deal with all of this. I mean, this has now become an article of faith for the Republicans.
I mean, I think one of the problems is that whatever happens during this pandemic, it could set a precedent, and quite often, you know, reforms that happen during emergencies are never actually go away. And I do understand if you're a Republican. I mean, personally, I don't want to see, I would prefer not to see a scenario where everybody does a mail-in ballot in general elections in perpetuity. I think there's a whole bunch of reasons why I don't love that idea, including kind of a romantic notion about going to the polls on election day, which I have an affinity for. There's something kind of patriotic and old fashioned about that. But having said that, I mean, I think that we have to prepare for November, and maybe there's a way to really stipulate that this is a special case. This will apply to 2020 and not necessarily be precedent, you know, in perpetuity.
No, I tend to agree, although I have to say that one of the things we're learning is that we don't always have to go to the office. We don't always have to just show up at the polls. That, you know, it is the 21st century, and there are ways of doing things. I also think that at some point we need to have a discussion about whether we really want people to vote or not. I'm serious. I mean, there is this. There's an ideological sense, at least on the right, that maybe we should make voting as hard as possible. Make it difficult to show some sort of a commitment. Yeah. Argument.
That's actually where I am, Charlie.
I know, and I understand that. I've been there in the past.
Yeah, I don't want to disenfranchise anybody, of course. However, I think that there should be some sort of effort involved in voting, because I don't necessarily want somebody who's never thought about the election, never thought about the candidate. This is sort of like the wait period for getting a gun or something like that, right? You know, it's like you need like a week to to sort of think about it. Like, I like the idea that you have put some thought into it before going and voting.
Okay, I have probably done a dozen radio shows making this point, saying that I actually like low turnout elections because at least you know the people who are showing up are motivated and probably know what they're doing. If people are not following the news, if they don't have any opinions, if they are absolutely clueless, then they are, to, you know, paraphrase your book title, they're too dumb to vote. And so it's okay. But if that morphs into public policy that effectively suppresses tens or hundreds of thousands of votes, that is a problem. And I do think that, you know, we throw around words like legitimacy too much, but this is really a legitimacy issue.
I agree. And I think that's what's happening in Wisconsin today is actually, you know, you were asking, not you, we are asking people to sort of put two competing values at play, right? On one hand, we're saying every vote is precious. You know, as a citizen, you have a moral obligation to go out and cast your vote. I mean, that's a very, I don't personally believe that is true, but that's almost saying otherwise is almost sacrilegious. You know, we encourage people to participate in democracy. And on the other hand, we're saying stay at home. And that the responsible, patriotic thing to do is to stay at home. I have right now on my Facebook page, you know, my avatar is a picture of me, and then it says like something like stay safe, stay at home. And we're basically now telling people that those two things are mutually exclusive. And so I agree with you that what's happening in Wisconsin is not appropriate. And certainly we cannot let that happen in November.
Right. No. And there's also a certain asymmetry to what's going on right now, where Democrats have shut down all of their get out the vote effort. And people like Bernie Sanders are saying, you know, I'm not urging people to get out and vote. The Republicans are still pushing, you know, yes, absolutely get out and vote. So, I mean, the results are going to be inevitably skewed in a way that people will question their legitimacy. But it is interesting, the different approaches of the different parties. OK, here's a little tidbit, though. Okay, so let's imagine that you are a person, a senior citizen, or somebody who has severe health problems, and you live alone, and you're afraid of going out in public and voting. Okay, I mean, there are people, I mean, that's not far-fetched. People who don't have somebody who lives with them who can easily witness the absentee ballot. So one of the things that happened was a federal judge ruled last week to change the rules about absentee voting in Wisconsin, that if you requested the absentee ballot and you were a shut-in and you didn't want to come out, that you would be able to vote without getting someone else to witness it. He suspended that because, let's say, again, you know, you're, you know, 78-year-old woman and you're living alone. You don't have anyone who can easily do it. In order for you to vote, you'd have to go and really risk your health by having someone come into your house or leave your house and have this contact with someone. So that's a problem. So the judge ruled, Judge William Connolly, ruled that you did not need to have the witness signature. So many voters, we don't know how many, then took the federal judge at his word, sent in their absentee ballot without the signature. Okay, so now fast forward to today, because now that's all been thrown out. So the state elections commissioner is saying that if you were one of those people and you returned a ballot without a witness signature in that period it was allowed, your ballot will not be counted and you will not be able to get another ballot even if you show up to the polls to vote in person today.
Yeah.
You are totally disenfranchised. You are totally screwed. Here's somebody that followed the rules, did exactly what they're supposed to do, followed a federal judge order, send in the ballot, and even if you show up today, even if you come out of your house and you show up today, you're not going to be allowed to vote. So that's how foobar this whole election is.
It's a disaster. So and I have to say too, Charlie, I think it's kind of almost unpredictable how this could play out, right? So look, it's entirely possible that everything's fine by November, but it's possible that it goes away and comes back, or that it just doesn't go away. You know, it's hard to say how it plays out, because I mean, I think the obvious assumption is that this hurts Democrats, like in a general election. People who live in urban areas would be more vulnerable.
Correct.
And people who live in urban areas tend to vote Democrat. But as you just mentioned, Charlie, there's also the age thing, where older voters are presumably much more susceptible to this and maybe less likely to come out. And that would presumably hurt Donald Trump.
It could. And by the way, in Milwaukee, and I mentioned this on the podcast in the article yesterday, in the city of Milwaukee, they have 300,000 registered voters, the heavily African-American city. And there are only five polling places in the entire city of Milwaukee. So the net effect of this is going to suppress the vote in certain areas. So by the way, I wasn't planning on spending too much time on this. What's driving this is really a state Supreme Court election, which has become really high stakes in Wisconsin. And President Trump has weighed in on all of this as if he's got any, you know, interest in the judiciary here in Wisconsin. But also there's a presidential primary, and Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are on the ballot. Now, Bernie Sanders is telling people don't come out and vote today. So that's the big asterisk on it. 4 years ago, Bernie Sanders beat Hillary Clinton by a big margin, but a poll came out last week showing Joe Biden with like a 30-point lead on Bernie Sanders. Now, on Earth 2.0, we're not in the midst of a pandemic. If Joe Biden were to win Wisconsin, you know, easily, a state that Bernie had won 4 years ago, I mean, that really would be the dagger. That would be like the final straw for Bernie, even in the delusional world of Bernie bros. But the way it's set up now, you can already see that Bernie is going to say he will discount any result that comes out because of this pandemic. So this will have no effect whatsoever on the race. I was just looking at a New York Times article. Is this Bernie's last stand? No, Bernie's already got a built-in excuse why he's going to ignore anything that happens today.
No, I think that's right. On the other hand, you know, again, look, the most important thing about this story is obviously the lives affected. But look, we're both political analysts. I'm going to put on my political analyst hat. I mean, I think probably this resounds to, or sorry, redounds. I think this is probably a net plus for Joe Biden overall, in the sense that, you know, look, I think Donald Trump had a lot of great things going for him heading into reelection, including the fact that incumbents, we tend to reelect presidents. He had that great economy. That's not there anymore. And I also think Joe Biden, although this experience has cost him a lot of momentum, a lot of headlines. I mean, there was that moment there after South Carolina and Super Tuesday where he really did seem to, for the first time, have a lot of energy and excitement. So he did lose that momentum. But he's now having this chance to really kind of rest and lay low. And then you have that contrasting with Donald Trump, who really botched the early stages of this coronavirus pandemic. So yes, I do think Bernie Sanders sort of hanging around, lingering, is certainly not perfect for Joe Biden. But overall, I think that his odds of being elected in November have actually increased in the last couple of months.
Yeah, I think that's a fair analysis. Okay, so let's switch to the news of the day. So what do you want to talk about? You want to talk about the Secretary of the Navy or the White House briefing? Just coin flipper.
I'd like to talk about the. I think the Navy is a much more
okay. I am so worked up about this, I have to say. Okay, so we know the backstory where we have the captain, the decorated captain of a U.S. aircraft carrier, the Roosevelt, who is so concerned about the spread of coronavirus on his ship that he writes a 5-page letter. Basically saying, look, you know, let's not put these men. We're not at war. We are our number one asset are the lives of our sailors. He writes this letter, and you know, a few days passes, and the acting Secretary of the Navy, Moodley, fires him. They remove him from this, and not content with removing him, firing him as captain of the ship. This is an amazing story to me. That the acting Secretary of the Navy then gets on an airplane and goes to Guam, where the aircraft carrier is, you know, is being, well, it's sort of, what do you call it, beached there for the moment. So the acting Navy Secretary, Thomas Moodley, goes and he gives a speech where he rips this the captain. And by the way, I should mention, I mean, the most compelling image of the last week was, you know, the captain being cheered by his men who understood, you know, that he was fighting for them, that he was standing up for them. It was almost the definition of leadership, and they were chanting his name. So Moodley decides to go to that ship. These men who obviously were, you know, deeply loyal and passionately supportive of the captain, and he rips him, says that he's too naive or too stupid to be the commanding officer of a ship like this. Let's play the audio of this, because I want to play the audio as well as some of the reaction from, because this was not well received.
Information age that we live in. And he was A, too naive or too stupid to be the commanding officer of a ship like this.
He speaks for all of us. So Moodley then puts out a statement saying, yeah, I meant every word of it. By the end of the day, he was apologizing about it. What's going on here?
So Moodley seems to be engaging in what I call trickle-down Trumpism. And I don't know if Trump ordered this, but it doesn't matter. Because when you're a leader, people take cues from you on how they're supposed to behave and how they're supposed to communicate. And so what we just heard was somebody being very Trumpy, sounding very much like Donald Trump. And I think a couple things come to mind. First, I think that there's just a pattern here in the Trump era where people who are decent, honorable leaders are punished. And so whether that's Lieutenant Colonel Vindman or whether that's this
the ambassador, Yovanovitch.
Yeah, So there's a pattern, and then there's a similar pattern of people who are rule breakers and bad actors being rewarded.
War criminals.
So we saw that, for example, with the Navy SEAL who was accused of war crimes, that, you know, or Sheriff Joe Arpaio. We see a clear pattern that people who are bad actors are rewarded. People who do the right thing are punished. And I think that just changes the whole incentive structure. And so what happens is you end up getting more bad behavior. And look, here's the thing that I find really interesting and ironic about it is that, you know, for a lot of my lifetime, Charlie, I heard people saying that we can't have women in combat roles, or we can't have gays in the military. And I was sympathetic, at least to the, or open, at least open to the arguments that people who said those things knew what they were talking about. And they talked about an esprit de corps, and they talked about, you know, the importance of unit cohesion, mm-hmm. you know, terms like that. And because I didn't serve, because I haven't served, I was at least open to hearing from people who have, talking about the importance of preserving unit cohesion. And there was a concern that, you know, doing some sort of social engineering could undermine that. Well, guess what? Donald Trump has done more to undermine morale and honor and integrity in the military, and especially in the special forces, than any sort of left-wing social agenda ever could. I can't imagine that you could do more to undermine honor, courage, and commitment than what
he's done. This is a very, very good point. This is really what a Trumpified military looks like, because you are right. I mean, you listen to that whole statement by Mobley, and he's ripping the media and he's making it partisan. And you realize you're the acting Secretary of the Navy, and you are talking to men on an aircraft carrier. And you really are channeling your inner Donald Trump. His refusal to apologize initially was also an indication. By the way, remember why he's the acting Secretary of the Navy, because the previous secretary resigned or was fired. I can't remember anymore, over the handling of the pardon of the war criminal. He wasn't going to go along with all of that. So this is what you get when you have a politicized, Trumpified U.S. Navy. But also, I mean, the visuals on this are so horrible. And the one thing I always try to the extent that I try to understand Donald Trump's mentality, if you think of the world as a TV show or a movie, you get a little bit of an insight. I'm trying to think of the movie in which Captain Crozier is the bad guy and Mobley covers himself with glory. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's just like, and you can sort of sense that Donald Trump is now kind of going, okay, that didn't look good. That didn't sound good. That was wrong.
Well, it's the same. It would have to be the kind of movie where, Johnny Lawrence is just this young guy who's in love with a girl named Allie, and this this hoodlum from New Jersey named Daniel LaRussa moves in into his neighborhood and steals Allie. And, so in other words, it's a perverse interpretation of the world is what you would have to do. Or maybe I think we have a mutual friend, Charlie, who thinks that, that the Empire and Star Wars are the heroes and the rebels are actually like terrorists.
Yes. But I disavow that. I'm a contrarian, but there are limits to my being contrarian. Okay, so yesterday at the news briefings, and it feels like it's an old debate about whether or not the network should be carrying the news briefings. But and we've said this before, well, that was the worst, that was the lowest, and of course, then it's like just wait a day. You're an analyst on CNN, so let's just flag that right away. I thought Anderson Cooper's comments after last night's briefing were very interesting. Let's play about a minute of that, okay? I want to just get your reaction.
The White House Coronavirus Task Force press briefing ended a short while ago, and if you tuned into it hoping to hear from the country's top scientists, you were likely disappointed. What we mostly heard was the president. What we saw was a hijacking of the task force press conference by a president determined to rewrite the history of his early and reprehensibly irresponsible response to this virus. What the president showed us today is what the nation's top scientists have to deal with every day. A president who now uses these briefings as a re-election platform, an opportunity to lie, to deflect, to attack, to bully, and cover up his own deadly dismissals of the virus for crucial weeks. According to the president today, all governors are getting everything they need, and testing is now and always has been great. Reporters who asked fair questions but didn't kowtow or suck up to this president were attacked and belittled, and a special venom was reserved for a career official at HHS who he doesn't even know, who released a non-political study with extensive interviews with doctors and hospitals across the country describing the lack of supplies and insufficient testing and mixed messages they've been getting from the federal government, all things that have been reported on.
Okay, this is was the question about the IG report, which certainly suggested that things were not going well. And just in case people have forgotten, because it was, I don't know, like Friday, the president has been purging these inspector generals, and he's been, you know, pushed to get rid of the, you know, deep state folks. But these are the independent, non-political, non-partisan.
Another example of what we were just talking about.
Exactly.
I mean, the inspector general who acted completely appropriately.
Right.
And yeah.
Okay. So Jonathan Carl from ABC, who's got a new book out, and we've known Jonathan Carl, I assume, for years. I mean, you've known him, and he's, you know, very well respected veteran reporter. Asks the president. This is an amazing moment. No, nothing should amaze us, right? Except you're going, is this real? Is this real life? Jonathan Carl asked the president of the United States about this inspector general report that goes really to the heart of how we are handling this, whether or not we are getting it right. And this is what happened. I want to play this, his attack on Jonathan Carl.
Been in government?
Did serve in the previous administration.
Oh, you didn't tell me that. Oh, I see. You didn't tell me that, John. You didn't tell me that. Did serve in the previous administration. You mean the Obama administration. Thank you for telling me that. See, there's a typical fake news deal.
You asked me when she was appointed. I told you when she was appointed.
You're a third-rate reporter, and what you just said is a disgrace, okay? You asked me, you said, sir, just got appointed. Take a look at what you said. Now, I said, when did this person, how long in government? Well, it was appointed in the Obama administration. Thank you very much, John.
Sir?
Thank you very much. You will never make it. Go ahead.
Okay. So Matt, I mean, you know, what the hell? You know, I mean, at what point are the networks saying, we're just not going to carry this bullshit anymore? This is not information. You know, as Anderson Cooper says, here's a president who basically hijacks it, and you have these snarky, vicious personal attacks on the reporters, which, I mean, no, they're big boys and they can handle it. But in the context of refusing to be held accountable or to answer legitimate questions.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's obviously like some sort of a collective action problem or something here, yeah. Right? I mean, what if only one network carries it live? They're going to get the ratings. I think definitely that, without a doubt, if the president says something, I mean, it's newsworthy. And yeah. But that doesn't mean it necessarily would have to be carried live, right? You could imagine a scenario where it's delayed and there's context provided. But again, it's great TV. Let's be honest. I mean, attacking Jonathan Carl is entertaining. And that's, you know, sadly, I mean, entertainment is going back
to the reality TV show. And let's face it, this is not a one-off. This is, the president would love to turn these briefings into the president versus the media, as opposed to the president versus his own record. Right. I mean, to the extent that we're talking about the exchange with Jonathan Carl, we're not talking about the extraordinary revelations that we've gotten over the last 24, 48, 72 hours about the disastrous response, the incompetence of the administration. And so the president knows that he can sort of throw up the chaff and look, and here we are. We're like going after the chaff, aren't we?
Yeah. And I also think there are perverse incentives too. I mean, I'm not accusing John Carl of this. And I do think, obviously, we need to ask, we in the media need to ask the president tough, difficult questions. They shouldn't be questions like, why are you so awesome? You know, that's what he wants, right?
The OAN questions. Yeah.
But I also think there is sort of a perverse incentive to try to inject yourself into the news cycle a little bit. Like, it's probably actually good for John Carl, who has a book out, I think,
yeah,
that he is in this skirmish with Trump. Like, I don't think he did that on purpose, but this is like a game where a lot of people benefit, except for, I think, the American public, probably.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, including the things that we've learned, I'm just looking at this Washington Post story, you know, inside Trump's embrace of a risky drug. And we have a great story by Tim Miller in The Bulwark that talks about his the business model of Donald Trump of peddling bogus health supplements. But I mean, this alone is one of those moments. And I gotta get your insight on all of this, because this is one of the strangest moments, I think, in American political history, where the president of the United States and his circle are pushing this unproven drug. But it's become this cultural touch point. Is it naive to ask why has it become so tribalized? I mean, do people just take sides, pro-Trump, anti-Trump, whether it's a drug, whatever? I mean, we just line up on these things, because there's nothing ideological about this drug, right? There's nothing ideological about a pandemic. And yet everybody's reaction seems to be colored by, are you red, are you blue, are you on Team Trump, or are you not on Team Trump?
Totally. And I think, look, the thing with this treatment is we don't know if it works. It may not. And there will certainly be complications if it does work. It may not work on everybody. There may be complications that could be even life-threatening for some people. But I think because Trump has gone out there and really hyped it prematurely, which I think is utterly irresponsible for a whole bunch of reasons, right? So for one reason, providing hope is really important for a leader to do. Providing false hope is actually demoralizing and undermines trust in government during a time when it's very needed. Also, obviously, we've had people who took some sort of like fish aquarium cleaner, you know. So it's really dangerous and just irresponsible for Trump to be hyping it to the degree he is. However, I think there's a real risk for those of us in the media, and I'll count myself among them, that we could, because we see Trump hyping it so irresponsibly, we could then end up sort of opposing it and rooting against it almost in the eyes of the American public. And I think that's a danger, because like there is a chance that this actually could be, after it goes through appropriate clinical, you know, studies, and there's peer review and there are control groups. I mean, maybe it does turn out that this helps some people. And I don't think it would be good for us to just sort of reflexively, to spite Trump, be cast as opposing this idea.
This is, of course, is the danger, because you know that there's going to be a narrative, a rewriting of the history if this thing comes to an end. Okay, so while you and I are speaking, and of course this is subject to change at any moment, Wall Street is stretching this rally into the second day. It was up hugely, bigly yesterday, and it's now up, as you and I speak, more than 800 points. We have the most influential coronavirus model revising its estimates downward. China, which I assume is lying, is reporting no new virus deaths. So there's a sense that, okay, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not an oncoming train. There is sort of a resurgence of optimism. Now, I'm putting these things side by side. 2 days ago, we had the Surgeon General saying this was going to be our 9/11 week. Everybody's been saying this week is going to be the deadliest. This week and next week are going to be the worst weeks, and there are going to be deaths. It's going to be horrible. We need to brace ourselves for it. And yet there seems to be this moment of optimism. Is it warranted?
Well, I think right now it does seem to be. But I think optimism is an interesting thing, because on one hand, I do think that we need to be optimistic that if we keep doing social distancing, it's not going to be for the rest of our lives. This is a temporary inconvenience for a long-term benefit. And we're not just doing it for us. We're doing it for our parents and our grandparents. I also think, though, there's a danger of optimism that people could revert back to, oh, this is no big deal. I can go to Walmart now. I can hang out with my friends. And And then, you know, that all starts over. And of course, there's the lag because you could be asymptomatic and pass it on. And so I do think that there are positive signs. I just worry that if we read too much into the optimism, we may not be as vigilant as we need to continue to be, certainly for several more weeks at least.
You know, this is one of the ironies, of course, is to the extent that we did, in fact, engage in the social distancing and did squash the curve. There will be people who will say, see, it was never that big a deal. You know, we overhyped it. So the success of the efforts to take it seriously will be used by folks on the other side to say we didn't need to do those things. Correct?
Yeah, it really is ironic. And it's so hard to like prove a negative, right? I mean, how can we prove that if you didn't listen to us, if you didn't listen to Dr. Fauci, it would have been horrible and millions of people would have died. But because you did that, they didn't. It's really hard to prove that and to document it. And so I think it does open up the potential for you know, sort of Trumpy people to come back with, see, this was always overblown. You destroyed the economy for no reason. And so it's one of those weird circumstances where, like, if you do the right thing, in a way it makes it the next time. Here's what I wonder about.
Yeah.
The next time something like this happens, if we manage to escape this and it doesn't become as bad. I mean, it was like a few days ago, Dr. Fauci said the conservative estimate was like 100,000 dead Americans. Like, what if we come in under that?
Yeah.
Trump declares victory. He saved all these lives.
Right.
The next time something like this happens, and I think we have to assume that this is going to happen a little more regularly than every 100 years. Will that actually serve to undermine the
sure.
warnings?
Well, and it's not just in the next 100 years. It's the way the waves of these pandemics, like the Spanish flu, they tend to come back within a series of months. So I've seen the charts showing that the curve goes up and it might come back. It might come back in the fall, might come back during the winter. And if that happens, are people going to, people who've endured this incredible economic pain, are they going to say, we're just not going to do that again? I think that's a very, very legitimate concern.
Yeah.
Plus, there becomes a tremendous investment on the part of the Trump administration and others to say, you know, no, we declared victory. We can't now go back and say, okay, we didn't win. We need to go back and fight the war all over again. I think that's a real concern.
It's so interesting. So from my knowledge of the Spanish flu, and I'll call it Spanish flu, yeah. even though it started in Kansas, apparently. My knowledge of the Spanish flu is that there were three waves. It basically lasted like over the course of a calendar year. And there were three waves. I think it went away during the summer. That may not happen this time, which actually could be good. Because if it goes away, then people may assume that it's gone forever, making them susceptible. I believe the second wave was by far the deadliest, right? And that potentially,
I think you're right. Yeah,
is a fear. And then, interestingly, the third wave. Some people believe that Woodrow Wilson, actually, the president, actually was afflicted in the third wave. So, I think this could be a little different. As far as I know, this may not go away because of heat in the summer. Ironically, that could help us. The other thing that happened during the Spanish flu was, people who got it in the first round were inoculated. They couldn't get it again. This thing may mutate. I'm not a doctor, but it's just it's such. I guess my whole point of saying all of this is, we should be cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I think that there's going to be, I mean, and this is going back, I mean, I'm trying to imagine, you know, when America starts opening up again, when the NFL season begins, there is going to be kind of a morning in America feeling, which is going to benefit Trump to a certain extent. Now, I think the economy is still going to be hurting. But once you have morning in America, if it starts to come back, I think we will have exhausted our national will. And part of it is in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, Americans have a notoriously short attention span. We can be outraged for only so long. We can be committed for only so long. We can do these things. And so I think the fall is a very dangerous point, which goes back to our original commentary about the election, that if this starts coming back and it starts happening around November, how will we respond? And unfortunately, yeah. I think that you'll see the reaction to that breaking down along strictly partisan lines, which is unfortunate and potentially deadly.
Mm-hmm. And so, there's so many like weird things about this, right? I think you're totally right, Charlie. I mean, there, for better or worse, and I think it's better and worse, Americans are about reinvention and we're about action and moving on. And we don't always, you know, there's a tension between what I would call individuality and solidarity. And, both political ideologies have strains of both, but I would say that Republicans and conservatives tend to be more in the rugged individualist camp. And we don't necessarily like to be told what to do, which I think is generally a good thing. The other weird thing about this is, I remember after 9/11, the message was, don't be cowed. Go out, go shopping, get together with friends. Don't, if you stay home and hide and worry, then the terrorists win. And I actually think that was an ethos that we could embrace as Americans much easier than the message here, which is like, if you want to be a hero, stay home and watch Netflix.
Yeah. I think that adds to the psychological burden, I think, that rather than feeling rallied, we do feel sort of alienated and atomized, and that we're not all in this together. So who knows? So by the way, I'm while we're talking, I'm looking at some pictures people are posting of lines at at polling places here in Wisconsin. At least they claim to be. This is the line somebody just posted. This is the line for in-person voting as the polls open for election day in Wisconsin. What's interesting is they put up orange cones to try to get people to engage in social distancing, which if you look at it, about a third of the way into the line, it sort of breaks down.
Yeah. One of the problems with that is if you're in a long line, you will be afraid that someone's going to butt in front of you in the line.
Yeah, especially with there's that much distance. But I will say it's impressive to look at this picture of how many people did show up to vote today in Wisconsin. I should actually mention this because it came up on the podcast yesterday. I waited until Friday to apply for my absentee ballot. Now, the deadline was Thursday, but that federal judge's ruling that said, you know, that it extended the deadlines, moved it to Friday. So I took advantage of Friday and got the ballot. And so I filled it out and I will be able to vote. Although in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, could somebody legally challenge my vote because I was able to apply for it the day based on this federal judge's ruling, which has now been thrown out? I have no, see, this is part of the confusion here. We just don't know what the hell's going on. So, yeah, all right. Good. So anything else that you're keeping an eye on? What's your next column going to be?
My latest piece at the Daily Beast is Peter Navarro warned Trump, but why didn't he warn us? And this kind of goes to our conversation earlier, Charlie, about how, you know, Peter Navarro did apparently in a memo and two memos, one of which was unauthored or unsigned, warned Trump about the dangers of pandemic, but he didn't get into a fight with anybody to push that argument. He didn't go on CNN and tell, you know, sort of broadcast that argument. He did it in a private memo, but when it comes to supporting this currently unproven drug, he has gone on TV and been an evangelist for it. And I think it speaks to what he knows, what Donald Trump wants and what Donald Trump likes, and that creates incentives for everybody else, whether it's somebody in the Navy or in the Navy SEALs or a labor advisor. They will reflect ultimately what Donald Trump wants.
Okay, so this connects the dots back to, again, to the Navy story. So let's actually, we'll connect all the dots of our entire conversation here, because there's obviously the incentive structure is you follow Trump's line. You know, if Trump wants a certain drug, you push the drug. If Trump says everything is fine, you say everything is fine. If you say that he made no mistakes, you have to say he made no mistakes. And if you are the person that raises your hand and say, Mr. President, we have a serious problem. The hospitals are not getting what they need, or my men are in danger, you're going to be slapped down. So there's now this tremendous incentive to not speak up, not issue the warnings. So if this does come back, and or even in the moment, you know, there's a real risk to telling the truth in the era of Trump.
Yeah. And by the way,
on an issue of life and death.
Yeah. Yeah. And let me just take it a little bit further. What do we see in China, where a doctor who is a whistleblower was not allowed to warn others and was actually persecuted by the Chinese government?
Yeah.
I mean, right now on, if you want a good watch, Charlie, The Death of Stalin.
Oh, I love that movie. Yeah.
Is on Netflix. And as you know, it's sort of, in some ways it's macabre, but it's also a very funny satire that I think actually pokes fun of the problems of an authoritarian regime and how dysfunctional and actually how that undermines. Even there's this scene where Stalin is dying and they can't save him because he's already arrested the best doctors, you know?
Well, do you remember, did you watch Chernobyl, the thing?
I did not, no.
Oh,
I did not.
No, go back if you have some time on your hands, which I think you probably do. go back and watch, you know, watch HBO's Chernobyl, because that's also about, you know, telling the truth. And there's a quote from there, which now I'm thinking about it, is where the key scientist basically says, you know, that every single time, you know, we tell a lie, it exacts a price, and you know, and the bill for those lies comes due at a certain point. This is actually the Chernobyl story, which seems like an indictment of this authoritarian regime, now seems very, very real. Because I guess I never thought we'd live through an era in which there would be this massive pressure not to raise the alarms, and in which you are actually rewarded for engaging in this sort of Panglossian, everything is fine, everything is wonderful. And it should be obvious that's dangerous. By the way, in the category of ideas have consequences, late last night as I was working on what's going on with the Wisconsin primary here and the sort of obsessive opposition of legislative Republicans to making any change, somebody was tweeting out the fact that the Speaker of the State Assembly, who I've known for many, many years, name is Robin Voss, very, very smart guy, but, you know, somewhat arrogant, that a few weeks ago, he was actively tweeting out Dr. Drew when Dr. Drew was saying this was no big deal, that it was just the flu, that we were overhyping it. So here you have the you know, an idea that gets out there, a guy like Dr. Drew, who's now apologized for everything he said, diminishing the danger and the significance of this. He puts it out there, and then policymakers like Robin Voss take it, they believe it, they push it out, and that kind of mentality is behind the public policy decision that's resulting in this election in Wisconsin today.
Yeah. No, I read. Yeah. So I think it was Peggy Noonan who used to say people, you didn't have to ask Reagan where he stood on a given subject because he had been very clear about the big things he believed in. And therefore, people who worked for him, they knew his worldview and they didn't have to go ask him about every little thing. They knew what he would want them to do. Well, I think Trump, I mean, his policies may be incoherent, but the big things that he wants to do, which is to win, to have the economy be perceived as being good, to have it be perceived that coronavirus isn't a big deal. People know what he wants and they act accordingly, and they don't have to go check with him, right? Remember the John McCain, was it an aircraft carrier or a ship or something? John McCain had to be rerouted or moved before a Trump event. Trump didn't order that. People did that because they knew what he would want and that he would freak out if he saw that. And so all these ideas do have consequences. And we have real leaders who do the right thing. And then let me just say this about Dr. Drew, because I have been listening. I started listening to Loveline with Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew Pinsky in the mid-90s before they even had an MTV show. And I have always loved that show. I think that they're a great team. Adam Carolla is hilarious. And I have really always respected and admired Dr. Drew. And if I was in my 20s and I heard Dr. Drew say what he was saying about coronavirus, which is that it's not a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
I would have listened to him.
Of course you would.
Because he had a lot of credibility and experience. And if he was saying it, I would have completely ignored, you know, the pearl clutchers. And I could have gotten sick as a result.
That's very easy to, you know, I mean, let's face it. Most of us have people that we trust, we listen to, and it's only when you realize that they are unreliable actors, you know, you have that moment of disillusionment, but some people don't give it up. By the way, while you were, telling me that's right, I looked up the quote from Chernobyl. Every lie we tell incurs a debt to the truth. Sooner or later, that debt is paid. Yep. That is so powerful. And this comes from the chief Soviet scientist who's just telling him, stop lying about what we face here.
At the risk of being accused of comparing Trump to the Soviets, I think you've just found your next column idea.
Yeah, the cost of lies. Well, it has been great, although, you know, somewhat, you know, I won't say discouraging. It's just that this seems like, and I've said this over and over again, so I apologize for repeating myself, but boy, it just feels like we're being tested, and the stakes of the test just keep getting higher and higher and higher, and they become more and more global, and it is the relentless unknown that we're facing, and I think that's what's so exhausting and I won't say debilitating, but it's that adds to the special level of anxiety that we're all feeling right now.
I think you're totally right. I think we just keep doing our thing. And let me just say, you guys are doing fabulous work.
Well, thank you.
Some shameless pandering here, but you're doing great work. When the Bulwark first started, I liked it, but I didn't know if y'all could keep it up.
We didn't either.
Or if you would. And it just keeps getting better. So congrats.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that very much. Matt Lewis, thank you so much. Senior columnist for the Daily Beast, contributor to CNN, author of one of my favorite books, Too Dumb to Fail, and a podcast host in his own right. So you're like a one-man media conglomerate, Matt. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Charlie.
All right. Thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.